All right. Welcome to another deep dive, everybody.
Yeah, welcome back.
You know, as always, we love getting your suggestions for topics and sources to, you know, explore. And we really are excited about this one.
This one is a good one.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't love a little, I don't know, deep thinking about Christianity and culture?
Right.
It's kind of like a perennial topic.
A perennial topic.
Yeah. So we got some really good material you guys sent in. Excerpts from Dr. Roger Green's lectures on American Christianity.
Right, specifically session 23, where he's talking about neo-orthodoxy and social crisis, and uses that to kind of unpack H. Richard Niebuhr's very, very influential book, Christ and Culture.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, for our listeners out there who maybe aren't super familiar with neo-orthodoxy, we should maybe just give like a really quick
A quick
definition.
Yeah, basically it's this theological movement that came about in the, I think it was like the early to mid 20th century.
It's somewhere around there.
That really emphasized a couple of key things. One is the transcendence of God, like God's completely otherness, and also the limits of human reason. Which makes sense when you think about the context, you know, coming out of the world wars and all the devastation.
Yeah, a lot of disillusionment going on.
Yeah, a lot of disillusionment with human progress.
So, yeah, I mean, we've got this great material from Dr. Green, and really, I think our mission for you in this deep dive is to get to grips with this framework that Niebuhr gives us for understanding how Christians have thought about their faith in relation to culture.
Exactly. Historically speaking.
Yeah.
The different models that have emerged.
And I mean, you know, it's a conversation that has been going on for centuries, right?
Oh, yeah. For as long as Christianity has been around, really.
Yeah.
There's been this question of how do we live in the world but not be of the world, right?
Right.
How do we be in the world but not of it, right? How do we negotiate that?
And it's still such a relevant question for us today, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, how do we live as Christians in a culture that often feels at odds with our values?
You got it.
Okay. So let's dive into this first model that Niebuhr talks about. The idea of Christ against culture. Or opposition between Christ and culture.
Right.
What's kind of the core belief behind that?
Okay, so at the heart of this model is the belief that Christ's authority is absolute, right? It's the only authority that truly matters. So if you hold to this view, your primary loyalty, in fact, your sole loyalty belongs to Christ.
So it's like an either.
Right, a sharp distinction.
Yeah.
So culture, with all its bells and whistles, social norms, political systems, the latest trends, whatever you want to throw in there, none of that has a legitimate claim on you.
Okay, so it's really about like a complete separation almost.
Yeah, and the Christianity that's being shaped by Christ is seen as something totally new. Hmm. A completely different order, a new kingdom, a new way of being in the world.
So it's not just like trying to find common ground or...
No, it's not about tweaking your cultural engagement. It's about like a radical break.
And Dr. Green points out that a lot of people who take this position point to the Bible for support.
Right, exactly.
You know, how do they read scripture in a way that leads them to this view?
So the way they see it is there's this consistent call throughout the Bible for God's people to be distinct from the world.
Yeah.
They see it as like a thread running from Genesis to Revelation, where there's this emphasis on separation and the teachings of Jesus. You know, especially those are often highlighted as this radical call to like leave behind the fallen world and follow him exclusively.
And that word radical is important here.
Absolutely.
Because it's not just about, you know, making a few changes here and there. It's about getting to the root.
To the root, yeah.
Of where your allegiance lies.
Right. It's about a fundamental shift.
Yeah.
In your worldview, in your way of life.
And Dr. Green mentions that this view is sometimes, though not always, connected to how people understand the end times.
Right. That's an interesting connection.
So how does that tie in? Like, how does someone's view of eschatology, you know, the study of the end times,
right,
affect their understanding of this opposition between Christ and culture?
So it's fascinating because when you have a strong belief that we're living in the final days and that all these earthly cultures and systems are temporary,
right,
and will ultimately face God's judgment,
mm-hmm,
it makes sense that your ultimate loyalty wouldn't be to these passing realities, but to the eternal kingdom of God.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right. And some who hold this view look back at the early church, you know, the first Christians,
yeah,
and they believe that they lived with this intense expectation of Christ's return.
Mm-hmm.
And so they lived in a way that was radically separate from the surrounding Roman culture.
Okay.
With their focus entirely on Christ and his coming kingdom.
Makes sense.
It's a powerful idea.
So if you really believe that, you know, that this world is passing away,
right,
that it would make sense that you would want to distance yourself from it as much as possible.
Yeah, and prioritize what's eternal.
Okay, so let's talk about the practical implications of this view.
Okay, yeah.
Because if this is your core belief, it's got to have some pretty significant effects on how you live your life, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So what are some of the ways this plays out, according to Dr. Green?
Well, for some who adhere to this model, it leads to this deliberate avoidance of many aspects of cultural life.
Like what kind of things?
Well, for example, they might see getting involved in politics or broader societal issues as pointless or even morally compromising, because those are all part of a system that's ultimately going to pass away.
Right.
They might be really committed to pacifism.
Okay.
Rejecting military service as an instrument of worldly power. They might also dismiss philosophy, you know,
yeah,
because it relies on human reason apart from divine revelation. They might even be suspicious of the arts.
Interesting.
Seeing them as expressions of fallen human nature that should be avoided.
So it's really about drawing some very clear boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah. Establishing clear boundaries between the Christian life and the world.
Okay. So Dr. Green gives some really helpful examples, both historical and contemporary, to illustrate how this model is played out.
Yeah. Let's look at some of those.
So let's start with monasticism.
Okay.
How does that, you know, illustrate this idea of opposition between Christ and culture?
Well, monasticism, in many of its forms, provides a really clear picture of this idea of separation.
Right.
You know, think about the early monks who sought solitude in caves.
Like literally withdrawing from society.
Literally withdrawing, yeah.
Wow.
Dedicating their lives to prayer and contemplation.
Uh-huh.
Intentionally cutting themselves off from the influences of wider society.
Right.
Or someone like Simeon Stylites.
Yeah, wasn't he the guy who lived on top of a pillar?
Exactly. He lived on top of a pillar for decades.
Wow. Talk about commitment.
I know, right? Like a very literal detachment from earthly affairs.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to get more separate than that.
Right. It's a powerful image.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, like, what did they see in that?
Yeah. What was the appeal of that kind of radical separation?
What were they striving for?
They were striving for total devotion to Christ, you know, unhindered by the distractions and temptations of the world.
Yeah.
And the example of the Trappist monastery really brings this home, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, wow. Talk about a disciplined life.
It's intense.
Poverty, chastity, obedience, silence.
Wow.
I mean, that's a complete rejection of so many things that we consider just normal parts of life.
Right. A radical reordering of priorities.
And Dr. Green mentioned how there are still young men today who are making those final vows.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Like a lifelong commitment to that kind of separation.
It's a powerful statement about what they see as most important.
Like, yeah.
They're saying, this world is not my home. My true home is with Christ.
It's really challenging, you know, because for most of us, we're trying to figure out how to live in the world,
right. But
also, you know, maintain our faith.
Yeah. To find that balance.
This is like the complete opposite of that.
It's the other end of the spectrum for sure.
And then Dr. Green brings in American fundamentalism as another possible example, which might surprise some people.
Yeah, that's an interesting connection.
So how does that fit into this model?
Well, Dr. Green suggests that within certain expressions of American fundamentalism, you can see elements of this opposition at work.
Okay.
The idea of a fallen culture from which believers need to remain distinct.
Yeah.
Often leads to a strong emphasis on the life of the church.
Uh-huh.
And a set of rules and guidelines to kind of keep people away from those negative cultural influences.
So it's almost like creating a separate Christian community.
Right, a kind of safe haven.
Yeah, like a bubble almost.
Yeah, almost like a bubble.
Okay, so that's the first model, the Christ against culture view.
Okay.
Now, Niebuhr himself didn't fully embrace this model.
Right. He had a more nuanced perspective.
He saw it as both necessary and ultimately inadequate.
That's a good way to put it.
So let's start with why he thought it was necessary.
Okay.
Like, what value did he see in this perspective?
Well, Niebuhr recognized that this model serves as this really important reminder for Christians about where their ultimate loyalty should lie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It forces us to ask that fundamental question, who or what truly has our allegiance, And he's saying, you know, it should be Christ
right.
and his kingdom alone, not any earthly culture.
Not these temporary things.
Exactly. But, yeah. He also saw it as necessary because it shines a light on the ways that cultures can often compromise fundamental Christian teachings,
okay.
sometimes in really damaging ways.
Right.
So it acts as a kind of prophetic voice, pointing out the stark differences between the values of God's kingdom and the values of the surrounding world.
Okay, so it's a good reminder to not just get swept along.
Right, exactly.
By whatever's popular or fashionable.
Yeah, to maintain a critical distance.
But then he also critiques this model as inadequate.
Right.
So why did he think it fell short?
Well, Niebuhr's main argument was that human beings are inherently cultural creatures.
Yeah.
You know, we live in communities, we create cultures,
yeah.
we're shaped by cultures, we can't escape it. Mm. Even groups that try to completely reject the mainstream culture end up forming their own distinct subcultures.
So they're not really escaping culture, they're just creating a different one.
Exactly. They're creating their own set of norms and practices.
Right.
And furthermore, Niebuhr believed that Jesus is Lord over all of creation, and that includes all cultures.
Right.
So a complete rejection of culture, he argued, doesn't fully acknowledge Christ's universal lordship.
Okay, so it's like it's too narrow a view of Christ's authority.
Right, it's limiting God's domain.
Yeah.
And the examples that he uses to illustrate this are really interesting.
Like, what are some of the examples?
Well, take monasticism, for instance.
Okay.
While the initial impulse might have been total separation,
okay.
history shows how monastic orders, especially in the medieval period, became incredibly influential.
Right. They ended up shaping culture in a lot of ways.
Yeah, they shaped art, architecture, language, learning.
Yeah.
They became this major force within Western culture.
So even though they were trying to withdraw from culture, they ended up shaping it.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it?
It is.
And as Dr. Green pointed out, even fundamentalist movements, in their effort to preserve their faith, you know, by separating from the world,
right.
they develop their own distinct cultural norms.
Like you can't escape it.
Yeah, it's part of what it means to be human.
All right. So that was the Christ against culture model.
Okay.
Let's move to the other end of the spectrum. The synthesis of Christ and culture.
Okay. The opposite end.
What's the main idea here?
So this model proposes that there isn't really a fundamental conflict between Christ and the world.
Okay, so it's a much more, I guess, optimistic view.
Yeah, much more optimistic.
Yeah.
Emphasizing harmony and alignment.
Okay.
So the teachings of the gospel and the laws and norms of a good society are seen as working together. Divine grace and human effort are complementary.
Yeah.
And the ethical principles of our faith fit in really well with the goals of social progress.
It sounds almost like a utopian vision.
Yeah, it does have a kind of utopian element to it.
So how does this model view Jesus? Mm-hmm. Is his role different here than in the opposition model?
Oh, definitely. In this view, Jesus is often seen primarily as a great moral teacher.
Okay.
An ethical example, a perfect role model, mm-hmm. who was totally at home, both within his cultural context and in his relationship with God.
Right.
So he's like the exemplar of how to live a virtuous life that aligns with both earthly and divine principles.
Okay. So it's less about him being a radical, you know, breaker of norms.
Right.
And more about him being like a perfecter of human ideals.
Yeah, exactly.
And what about the ultimate goal of culture in this model? Like, what are we striving for?
The goal is often described as shalom.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've heard that term.
Right. It's a Hebrew word that encompasses this idea of peace, well-being, and cooperative human existence.
Yes. Like a flourishing.
Yeah, flourishing of all things.
And in this model, we can achieve that through our own efforts.
Right. Through social and ethical development.
Okay.
So there's a strong belief in human capacity to create a better world.
So it's less about waiting for God to intervene and bring about his kingdom.
Yeah, and they often downplay the need for that kind of language, believing that we have the power to create a world that's pleasing to God through our own efforts.
Okay, that makes sense.
It's a very humanistic perspective.
Yeah.
And this model tends to be very inclusive.
In what way?
Well, it sees value in all cultures and religious traditions.
Oh, okay.
As different paths potentially leading to this shared goal of shalom.
Right.
So there's not a lot of judgment or critique
okay.
of any particular culture or religion. It emphasizes a multicultural and multi-religious approach.
So it's all about working together for the common good.
Exactly. Focusing on shared values and collaborative efforts.
So Dr. Green gives a couple of examples to illustrate how this model has worked out historically.
Yeah.
So the first one is deism in the 18th century.
Okay.
How does that fit into this model?
Well, deism, with figures like Thomas Jefferson,
yeah,
really embodies a lot of these ideals.
Okay.
There's a strong emphasis on reason, natural law,
mm-hmm.
and a belief in a benevolent creator who doesn't necessarily intervene directly in the world.
Right.
So that aligns with this idea that humanity has the capacity to build a just and moral society
yeah.
through its own rational and ethical efforts.
Through our own efforts.
Right.
Not necessarily relying on divine revelation.
Right. It's about human agency and progress.
And then the other example is classical liberal Protestantism.
Right.
And that's really interesting because it seems like there have been some pretty diverse, maybe even strange manifestations of that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So what are some of the ways that this model has played out in classical liberal Protestantism?
Well, Dr. Green gives this great anecdote about Judson Memorial Church.
Yeah, I remember reading about that.
With its Walt Disney hymns, Coca-Cola communion.
And the tumbling team as a call to worship.
Right, the tumbling team. It's like, what?
I know, it's really out there.
So it seems like they're really pushing the boundaries of what it means to incorporate culture into religious practice.
Right. They're really embracing a wide range of cultural expressions.
Yeah.
Seeing them all as potentially valid and in harmony with faith.
Yeah.
It's a very, very inclusive approach.
So it's definitely a different way of thinking about the relationship between Christ and culture.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, just like with the opposition model, Niebuhr saw this synthesis view as having some value, but also ultimately being inadequate.
Right. He had a more critical perspective on it.
So what did he see as the necessary aspects of this model?
Well, Niebuhr recognized that it offered this really important corrective
uh-huh.
by emphasizing that Christ can't be confined to any single culture.
Right. He's the Lord of all.
Right. Exactly.
And as the creator of all humanity, his influence and relevance extends across all cultural boundaries.
It makes sense.
Right. It's a universal message.
And this perspective also allows for more comfortable interaction with people who might be skeptical or critical of traditional Christian beliefs.
Right, because you're meeting them on their own terms.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Schleiermacher engaging with the intellectual elites of his time.
Exactly, finding that common ground.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Building bridges, opening up dialogue.
So that could be a really valuable approach.
Absolutely.
But Niebuhr also had some major criticisms of this model.
Yeah, he saw some serious flaws.
So what were his main concerns about this synthesis approach?
Well, his fundamental criticism was that this model tends to downplay or even ignore the radical nature of the gospel.
Okay, so he felt like it was kind of watering down the message.
Yeah, kind of smoothing out the rough edges.
Yeah.
He argued that the call to follow Christ demands a primary allegiance that can't just be blended in with the values of any given culture. There's going to be some tension there.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that.
And drawing on those neo-Orthodox ideas,
mm-hmm.
he stressed the inherent sinfulness of human-created cultures.
Okay, so even though culture can reflect God's goodness,
right,
it's also tainted by sin.
Exactly. It's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
And he was also concerned that this view often leads to an uncritical acceptance of one's own culture as being aligned with God's will.
Right.
Without recognizing its limitations and its potential for injustice.
So it can be a very comfortable view.
Yeah, very comfortable.
But maybe not a very honest one.
Right. It can lead to a kind of blindness to the flaws within our own cultures.
And he raises a really important point about the implications for judging harmful cultures.
Yes, that's a crucial ethical question.
Because if you're operating from this position of complete synthesis, you know,
right,
where all cultures are seen as equally valid,
right,
how can you critique or condemn something like Nazi Germany?
Exactly. Where do you draw the line? And say, this is fundamentally incompatible with the teachings of Christ.
It's a really tough question.
It is. And Niebuhr felt like the synthesis model didn't adequately address that.
Okay, so we've looked at these two extremes.
Yeah.
The stark opposition between Christ and culture and the hopeful synthesis where they're seen as largely harmonious.
Right. Two ends of the spectrum.
Now, let's dive into Niebuhr's own preferred middle ground. Christ and culture in tension.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting.
So what's the core idea here? How does he try to navigate between these two poles?
So this model attempts to bridge the gap, not by choosing one over the other, but by acknowledging the inherent tensions that exist between Christ and culture.
Okay, so it's not either, it's both hand.
Right, both hand.
Yeah.
So the key principles here are, first, that Jesus Christ is Lord over all creation, and that includes every aspect of human culture.
Right.
Second, that the natural world, the foundation of culture, is inherently good because it was created by God. However, and this is crucial, human-shaped culture, while drawing from that good foundation, is often tainted by sin and can become a source of evil.
So it's both good and bad.
Yeah, it was this mixed bag.
Yeah.
But despite this tension, there's this vital principle. All truth is God's truth.
Yeah, that's a powerful statement.
It is.
So how does that principle, you know, all truth is God's truth,
how
does that guide engagement with culture within this model?
Well, it suggests that Christians should be actively involved in serving and contributing to culture wherever they find truth, goodness, and beauty, regardless of where it comes from.
Right.
So obedience to God isn't limited to just explicitly religious activities.
It's about living it out in the world.
Exactly, living it out in the everyday world. It's about recognizing that God's grace can be at work even in imperfect cultural expressions and participating in the pursuit of truth and justice wherever we find it.
So it's a much more active engagement with culture.
Yeah, more dynamic and discerning approach.
Okay, so Dr. Green gave a couple of really great examples to illustrate this model in action.
Let's look at those.
The first one is St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah, a towering figure in Christian thought.
So how does his work embody this tension between Christ and culture?
Well, Aquinas, with his integration of Christian theology and Aristotelian philosophy, prime example.
Okay.
He believed that human reason was a gift from God.
Right.
A tool to be used in understanding all aspects of reality.
Not something to be rejected.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that includes culture.
Okay.
So this perspective encouraged Christians to engage with and contribute to all areas of culture.
So not just the explicitly religious stuff.
No, all of it.
Yeah.
Political, social, artistic, intellectual, the whole gamut.
Okay.
Recognizing the potential for God's truth to be discovered and expressed even within those secular spheres.
So it's not about creating this separate Christian sphere.
No, it's about being salt and light in the midst of the world.
And the educational philosophy of many Catholic universities today still reflects this influence, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like this emphasis on integrating faith and reason across disciplines.
Right. It's about seeing the connections between faith and all areas of knowledge.
And then the second example, which I found really fascinating, is the letter to Diognetus from the second century.
Yeah, that's a great one.
And it seems to really capture this sense of living in two worlds at once.
It does. It's a beautiful expression of that idea.
So what's so insightful about this ancient letter?
Well, it describes Christians as not being defined by earthly categories.
Okay.
Like nationality or language.
Right.
But they still live within their societies, following local customs, but they also have this primary allegiance to their heavenly citizenship.
So it's like they're living in both worlds at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's this great line where it says, Christians are in the flesh, but do not live according to the flesh.
That's powerful.
Isn't it? Yeah. They're described as marrying and having children, but not abandoning newborns.
Right.
They share a common table, but not a common bed.
So they're participating in society, but also living by a different set of standards.
Yeah, it's this paradoxical existence, this dual loyalty to both earthly and heavenly realities.
Yeah, that really captures the tension.
Right. And it's noteworthy that they're described as obeying the established laws, but also living according to a higher standard.
So they're not just conforming to the culture.
No, they're transforming it from within.
Yeah.
And this idea of being in the world but not of the world really resonates with Niebuhr's model.
It's amazing how this ancient letter still speaks to us today.
It's timeless.
And Dr. Green makes it clear that this Christ and culture intention model is where Niebuhr himself ultimately lands.
Right. It's his preferred approach.
So why do you think that is?
Well, I think Niebuhr saw this middle ground as the most accurate way to understand the complex relationship between Christ and culture.
Okay. It's not easy.
Right.
It's challenging.
Yeah.
But it avoids the simplicity of either complete withdrawal or uncritical acceptance.
So it's about finding that balance.
Right. Finding that dynamic tension.
Yeah.
And living in that space.
Well, it's not about choosing one side or the other.
No, it's about holding both intention.
Yeah.
And constantly striving to discern God's will within that complex interplay.
It's a journey, not a destination.
Exactly.
And it's interesting that Niebuhr doesn't offer any critique of this model.
Right. He seems to have a deep conviction in its validity.
Okay, so to wrap things up, we've explored these three models of how Christians have thought about their relationship with culture. The stark opposition between Christ and culture, the optimistic synthesis, and then Niebuhr's preferred middle ground of tension.
Right. Three distinct approaches.
And Niebuhr, as Dr. Green explained, believes that this tension-filled approach is the most accurate and demanding way to live out our faith.
It's a call to thoughtful engagement.
Right.
And faithful discernment.
Yeah. In a complex world.
So for you, the listener, as you reflect on your own life,
yeah,
which of these models do you see at play?
In your own experience.
Which one resonates most with your own understanding and experiences of navigating your faith within our current culture?
That's a good question.
And what do you see as the strengths and weaknesses of each of these perspectives?
It's worth pondering.
Because it really is a complex and ongoing journey for all of us.
Absolutely.
And we hope this deep dive has given you some helpful lenses.
Some new ways of thinking about this.
To consider your own place within this dynamic.
That's what we hope for.
And just a heads up, we'll be continuing our exploration of American Christianity.
Right, based on Dr. Green's lectures.
In our next deep dive.
Looking at fundamentalism and evangelicalism.
So make sure you tune in for that.
We'll see you then.
Yeah, see you then.
Bye.